Thank you, honey.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Dr. Mark Ibsen and Susan Fransheim. They have a very interesting story about a positive outcome, uniquely, at a medical licensing board. And without further ado, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Ibsen to discuss exactly what happened and the positive outcome just a few days earlier.
Thank you, Dr. Joshi. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm still a little shell-shocked, honestly, so I won't be my usual animated self, and you'll understand why. So in December of 24, I appeared in a panel with the Cato Institute, interviewed by Dr. Jeffrey Singer. The panel included Brandi Stokes, a patient of mine, myself, Kate Nicholson, and Ron Chapman. In that session, I emoted quite powerfully about the heartbreak I have over multiple pain patients who died after having access to my care. I quit prescribing opiates in 2017 when another doctor, Dr. Chris Christensen, in Montana, was convicted of manslaughter for helping patients. It became clear to me at that time that I was facing a hostile regulatory environment. I'd been visited by the DEA five times, and they told me, Dr. Ibsen, you're risking your freedom and your license by helping patients like these. And I said, patients like who? And they said, patients who might divert your pain medication. And I said, isn't that everyone? And they said, well, we can't tell you what to do. We're not doctors. So the writing was on the wall for me back then. My kids were in high school. I was reeling from the fight I was having with the Board of Medicine for overprescribing when, ironically, I had tapered 80% of my patients off of opiates, and they were eager to taper because they didn't want to ever go through what the Board of Medicine and the regulators in Montana made them go through. So when I noticed that, I noticed that 20% of my patients couldn't possibly taper off of their opiates, and they had no place to go. There was no place for me to send them. They were like, no insult to patients or tar babies, but they were tar babies, and I couldn't get rid of them. I couldn't place them anywhere. There was nothing I could do, and no pharmacies in town would fill my prescriptions. So it was futile, and I gave up or surrendered or something like that. So that was in 2017. In 2022, in November, a lot of new pain refugees were created when Dr. Bokoff lost his license. And I started taking patients who were pain refugees in other states because it wasn't so safe for me to treat anybody in Montana. And it turned out that because of COVID emergency guidelines issued by the DEA and extended every year and now all the way through 2025, I found it was possible for me to write a prescription, do a telemedicine visit in Montana, and if the patient had a prescriber that would fill it, then they could get their medications. Several states, I had problems getting patients, their prescriptions filled. And my one patient in Maine, when I accepted her as a patient, I sent her prescription in to the pharmacy that she'd used for 9 years. And this is all summarized in the Cato thing. And her nurse practitioner who was forced tapering her called that pharmacy and told them not to fill my prescription. And from that point on, she was going week to week with prescriptions at different pharmacies throughout the state of Maine. At some point, the state of Maine sent me a cease and desist letter saying I could no longer do that. I had to have a Maine license, which I didn't check all 50 states for what their requirements were. I figured that the federal law trumps state law. So I've been prescribing to patients in multiple states. So when I did the Cato Institute presentation, and I mentioned that I had six patients who died, and I mentioned their names, but not their cause of death. I did mention that three of them died of gunshot wounds, two died of alcohol complications, and one died of an amitriptyline or non-opiate overdose. The Board of Medicine saw that and said I had violated their HIPAA rights. And all of these patients had been mentioned in lots of different articles in the past. So it was well known that these patients died from lack of opiates, and that their protected health information had not been released, contrary to what the board was accusing me of. After that accusation, which happened, I think, 3 days after the presentation, so they were tuned in to watching it, the board sent me a notice saying, well, you may have violated HIPAA, and we want you to come and explain. And they gave me a couple of weeks to prepare, and we ended up getting that postponed into February so we could adequately prepare. At the hearing itself on Friday, February 21st, once again, the Board of Medicine operates in this bizarre, unconstitutional way by having this hearing where I couldn't speak, and my attorney was with me at the hearing. He couldn't speak either. So an attorney presented the case of the patient who died, one of the patients who died. And I noticed that it was, if he was an intern, he would have failed his presentation. So he's a lawyer and he doesn't know how to make a medical presentation. And I was thinking, gee, I could present this case so much better. It's been with me for years, but why didn't they ask me to present it? I don't know. They don't want to hear what I have to say, apparently. So at any rate, the lawyer made the presentation like Dr. Ibsen saw this patient and he abandoned the patient and the patient killed himself and Dr. Ibsen's at fault. And that is, nothing could be further from the truth. When I retired, I stopped treating all patients. I gave them all 30-day notices, and I gave them all referrals to other doctors. And I lost track of a lot of them, but I never lost track of this patient because he went to the other doctor I sent them. The other doctor did a bunch of injections, and his pain got worse, and he came back to me begging for help, saying that if I didn't help him, he'd kill himself. And he was true to his word, and he did kill himself after having been taken to the ER by his family, and they released him from the ER. They released a suicidal patient. And then his family, of course, didn't secure his guns, and he had another gun that he didn't let them know about, and he found that, and he was just determined to kill himself as a form of protest, I think. So he didn't – shooting yourself in the head is no way to maintain your privacy. It is an act of disobedience. It is an act that's meant to be public. If you wanted to do it in a more subtle way, you sure could. And the courage and desperation it takes for you to blow your brains out when you're trying to make a point is, well, it's dramatic. And it was a very dramatically made point.
So talk a little bit about your relationship with these patients, just the camaraderie that you've built over time and the trust that you had to where you felt they would feel comfortable remembering their memory by bringing it up in avenues like Cato Institute, where you're discussing this very thing, the over-regulatory nature of healthcare.
Well, so all of my patients knew, because I was in a fight with the Board of Medicine through the entire period between 2012 and Friday, they knew that my ability to prescribe for them was tenuous and it could disappear at any moment. And so most of our conversations were related to how are we going to take care of you now? How are you going to take care of yourself later if you need someone else besides me? What other options can you do besides the options the 80% of people who weaned from? And most of those patients weaned off of opiates using cannabis, and they were on fairly low doses. That was the low-hanging fruit. So we were all kind of in the same boat, in the same storm. That is to say, I was worried about my career and going and my freedom and going to prison. That had been threatened to me, and they were worried about their lives. And they realized, having been through it before, that if they were to lose their medicines again, they weren't going to survive it. I believe that there are myths in the medical practice, and one of the myths I was taught is that people on opiates don't die from opiate withdrawal. They just wish they would. But the studies on those patients were in 20-year-olds. And a 20-year-old cardiovascular system can probably survive withdrawal from opiates. So those were heroin addicts, and they all suffered greatly when they went into withdrawal, and none of them died. And so that was the common knowledge, not correct, but common knowledge that I was trained with. And now I have middle-aged or elderly people who are going through withdrawal, and it is a huge demand on their system. For example, Brandy Stokes, the patient I talked about on Cato, she had blood pressures in the 220 over 180 range ongoingly without her pain medication and despite antihypertensive medicines. So I'm kind of promoting this idea of the fourth vital sign instead of the fifth vital sign. That's to say that, okay, the fifth vital sign, people push back against that, and it's not really a vital sign. It was designed for us to develop the intention to assess people's pain relief. And I thought it was a great idea, but many people didn't. But now what I realize is you can't control the hypertension that is going on in people who are withdrawing with blood pressure medicines. You can give them four blood pressure medicines and they still are hypertensive and in agony. So maybe the fourth vital sign will catch on, you know, like check their blood pressure and manage their pain so that their blood pressure is okay. So I think I lost track of your question. Oh, my relationships. Yes. So I got very close to these patients, and I was in the unique position since my clinic had shut down. I had time to talk to them, and I realized that our conversations were actually what was keeping these patients alive. In other words, yes, they needed medications, but the context that I provided them, I listened deeply. I empathized with them. I asked them for their input. And we got into a collaborative relationship. And I think that's part of what's sacred in the physician-patient relationship. In fact, I developed this pattern that if a patient really wants to do something and they found it out on the internet and I'm skeptical, if it's not going to kill them and I say yes, that improves our relationship. I call that the alignment effect instead of the placebo effect. But these people and I were close, very close. Several patients, you know, they invited me over. I never went, but they wanted to be friends. And we hugged each other at the end of our clinic visits. And they knew that I was standing between them and certain death, either death by cardiovascular collapse or death by suicide or death by risking their own health on the black market. So, yeah, we were all close.
So talk a little bit about how HIPAA was applied. HIPAA is a very unique law in that, I guess for lack of a better term, it can be applied however many ways to however people it wants. It can be a civil statute. It could be a criminal statute. It can be a little bit of both. How was HIPAA applied to you? Knowing that the cause of death among these patients was known, that newspaper outlets had already reported the cause of death and the circumstances around that, it was public domain, it was on social media sites, what sort of violation of HIPAA was it that you specifically spoke about the patient, knowing that you had treated a patient, or what did the board feel like you were disseminating new information that wasn't previously known?
Well, I'm going to be, I want to say this in as positive a light as I can, because I see that there's an opportunity for me to get better related to the board now. But at the time, what I heard them say is, Dr. Ibsen, you may have violated HIPAA.
May.
And that, of course, shifted the burden of proof to me. And they're the ones making the accusation, so they should come up with the burden of proof as far as I'm concerned. So what happened between the accusation and our preparation is my attorney, John Flannery, wrote an impressive brief to them. The last time I appeared before the medical board, I wasn't prepared in this kind of way. I was a deer in the headlights, and I came prepared to talk to them, but they didn't want to talk to me. So they used their information, and that disinformation that they used at the first screening panel hearing, it took me 10 years and $350,000 to overcome. So I was not that interested in another screening panel hearing where the board misinterprets and deliberately misinterprets the information. So it turns out, Jay, that the in the hearing that I had, HIPAA was never mentioned. because my attorney addressed it. And he addressed it brilliantly in the briefs he sent. And he found all kinds of instances where each patient had revealed their desires and the expectation that I would have permission from a person who might be suicidal to talk about it with others. How do you get that permission in advance? Do you talk to every patient and say, you know, if you kill yourself, I'm going to tell about it, okay? And it's like, it's not a therapeutic conversation to have that in that context. So essentially, I didn't believe I violated HIPAA, and it turns out the board, once they were informed about everything, they didn't bring HIPAA up in the hearing itself anyway. So I think there was no there, but it cost me about $40,000 to find that out.
Wow.
In legal fees.
Yeah. So let's do this. Susan, I think this would be a critical, and then I can kind of open it up. I'd like to get both of your perspectives on the actual day of the hearing itself. So Mark, maybe you can talk through the actual hearing itself, going to the room where the hearing took place, the actual hearing itself, and then Susan, from your perspective, just observing everything that was going on in the room, if you can give your perspective. I think it'd be very important for the audience to just get a first person perspective on everything that transpired.
Yeah.
Got it.
Okay. It's a Zoom room. So, I'm on the camera just like I am right now. And the first agenda for a screening panel hearing is this claim that if anybody has anything they want to share that's not related to the case, they are welcome to share it. But if it's related to the case, they can't. Well, 59 patients tried to get into the Zoom call, and many other people were thwarted because there were some problems with the links. The beginning part of it was five different patients were able to share about their pain story. And I was surprised they let them, but evidently the board thought this was about HIPAA. So if we're going to talk about pain, it's not really on the agenda. So they let them talk. So five different patients of mine were able to talk. Then they closed it and they said, well, we're going to start talking about the individual cases. And I was number two on the docket. So for about 40 minutes, they were talking about some other case and we were waiting. And everybody, whenever they were talking about another case with another doctor, we were all locked out. We were in the waiting room and not certain when they were going to come back. And it's let's just say it's not a highly customer service oriented event. So then they came to me and I was the second case and I knew it was going to be me because mine had a 2018 date on it. As to the number, the numerical identifier of the case, everybody else, there were 15 cases that day. Everyone else had a 2024 or 25, number on it. So I knew which one was mine. So then we begin and we wade into it. And that's when the attorney for the board presented the case. And he basically said, you know, this patient was a pain patient, saw Dr. Ibsen. Dr. Ibsen stopped prescribing. The patient killed himself. It's Dr. Ibsen's fault. That was incredibly either inept or deliberate disinformation. I couldn't tell. And I thought I was going down in flames because, just because of the lies or the omissions. You know, he didn't say anything that was untrue. He just presented it in a way that favored his point of view. After that, there were some the board president said, it's time for us to go into executive session. And in an executive session, the board attorneys are supposed to be able to give advice to the board members strategically or litigation-wise. And my attorney said, wait a second. And this is John Flannery. And he said, I'm here. Dr. Ibsen is here. Why are you going into an executive session where you're discussing the case and something that's in a board book that you've already initiated, you have evidence in there and we can't see it? That is violation of due process and you may not do that. And then they did it. So they went into an executive session and I thought, oh, this is going to take years to get cleaned up. And they came out of executive session And the Dr. Geyer, the leader of the screening panel, began to delineate that they were going to dismiss it. And they decided to dismiss it based on the fact that they didn't talk about HIPAA. And my briefs already did that. And they said, you know, Dr. Ibsen referred this patient. He gave him 30 days, sent him to another doctor, was willing to see him again, and didn't abandon this patient at all. And so we say, we're going to dismiss it. And I was shocked. You could have knocked me over with a feather, because I finally found somebody at the Board of Medicine that was willing to read something that I provided. He didn't listen. They didn't ask me any questions. Still, there was no cross-examination. And I'm just shocked that you don't get a chance to present your case when you're talking about a medical case. But, I mean, I think that's the difference between the medical model and the legal model. And yeah. what my colleagues don't understand is that when you're called before the Board of Medical Examiners, it's neither medical nor an exam unless it's a rectal exam. And then I guess maybe it is. But other than that, there's no curiosity there. They've got an agenda, and they're going to go through it, and they're going to decide based on the evidence that they've decided is appropriate. But they don't examine the doctor. They don't interview the doctor, and it's just pathetically inept. And I feel bad for them, because they had 15 cases to go through, and I'm interested in presenting to them the idea that if you want 3 cases to go through instead of 15, you might want to mediate this in a way that gets it resolved, that gets to the truth of the matter. Like, if someone asked me, like you just did, tell me the story of this case, well, it flows off the tongue for me. And so it makes a lot of sense when I tell it, and it makes a lot of sense that I'm a criminal if you listen to the way they tell it. And if I don't get to tell my story, then this disinformation goes on and on. And last time it happened, it cost me about $350,000 to overcome.
Yeah.
So I was really pleased at my representation by my attorney, which was costly. But ultimately, he saved me 2 or 3 years of litigation and appeals and all that sort of thing, which would have been even more than the $40,000 I spent. So in that regard, I see a little crack. Like, maybe they're ready to listen. The other thing, Jay, of course, is in 2013, I didn't have articles and evidence and proof that only 1% of patients develop addiction. That's all out there. That's all settled science. And maybe they're starting to shift a little bit, because they don't have the facts and they don't have the law. And of course, a very famous thing to say in legal proceedings: if you have the facts, pound the facts. If you have the law, pound the law. If you have neither, pound the table. And they've been pounding the table with me for like 15 years. So I'm really pleased that a Hail Mary pass happened. And Susan can tell you about that. But I'm just shocked that it happened, and I'm glad that it happened. And maybe there's an opportunity to upgrade how we do medical board inquisitions.
Well said. Susan, what was your perspective of the whole event?
Well, first of all, I am certain that it was a fishing expedition, that they came up with HIPAA only in December of 24, after holding this case open for 7+ years, and that they believed that they had him finally. So John Flannery put the kibosh on that. And what Mark reported was that the lawyers wanted to sanction him, and the doctor or doctors said he did nothing wrong. And that was talking to the lawyers, saying that Mark stopped the medication, the patient committed suicide because of that. And the key thing was what happened with the emergency room and other aspects. So to me,
and the groundswell of responses from my patients that you generated, Susan, that there were impassioned letters written, phone calls made. One of my patients delivered 6 copies of my book to the Board of Medicine without my fingerprints on it. So there was an outcry of support for me, generated by Susan. Thank you so much, Susan.
Well, Mark told me about his hearing many years ago where a woman that he was working with managed to fill the hearing room with an overflow of Mark's patients. And the headlines in the Helena paper was essentially, there was no room for all of Dr. Ibsen's patients. I took that as an idea, an inspiration to mobilize our pain community by requesting that they send to the board outreach concerned with what they think and feel about Dr. Ibsen's work. What I didn't realize was that many of these patients have been stuck in feeling hopeless and helpless. This gave them an opportunity to be effective. My estimate is upwards to 1,000 or more people sent outreach to each and every board member. People sent overnight FedEx. The idea was that they not talk about what's going on in their lives. They focus on Dr. Ibsen. And they had at the beginning, as Mark said, 59 on the Zoom call. By the time I got off, it was up to 75.
Wow.
Jay, I want to tell you how it felt, because you asked me about the emotional relationship between me and my patients. I felt like George Bailey at that scene where everybody in town brings all the money and puts it in the basket. And his brother flies in a storm, and Bert and Ernie are there, and you know, that bell rings, and an angel gets their wings, and I felt like that guy. Wow. And in that moment, I felt that all of the pain that I've been through, and all of the frustration, and banging my head against this wall, it was all momentarily gone. Like, okay, that's enough for me. People can see what I'm up to. People can see that this is a problem that needs addressing, and we just need more of it. And I'd like to export this model to any of my colleagues. Basically, don't settle for anything. Get public immediately if someone comes after you. Resist, push back, get public. The tendency for us doctors is to be ashamed that we're being investigated. It's quite a humiliating experience. You know, I was on the headlines and they were talking about my mental health and I was crazy and blah, blah, blah. And that's all true. I'm crazy in a good way. But it was so humiliating to have people discussing my medical practice without my having an opportunity to say about it. So I was moved and touched by the whole thing and thrilled that my patients stood up and stood by me. And I'll tell my colleagues this. You can trust your patients to stand by you.
Yeah. Yeah, you
ask them to and they will.
Yeah. No, and as you and I both know, I mean, we share that similar experience where when everything has been taken from us, it's the patients that stand with us. And I think that it's a very unique relationship that you can have with patients, that you and I both have had with patients, where they'll stand by you, and it's a testament to how good of a physician you are. And what's very interesting is that this whole notion of going public really lends credibility to the fact that a lot of these regulatory agencies, federal regulators, state regulators, are not applying the law as it's intended to. Instead, they're just trying to implement anything. And it's really going along that Russian proverb where it's like, show me the man and I'll show you the crime. And I think that your experience really lends credibility to the fact that physicians need to go public. physicians need to lean into the regulatory and legal system and make sure that their voices are heard. Sorry, Susan, go ahead.
It looks like she's reconnecting.
Yeah.
There we okay.
go. Jay, there's one other thing. It wasn't just the patients of Mark's. It was also their families and their friends. This exploded. And the thing that I noticed that surprised me the most when I saw examples of the outreach is how civil they were. They were sticking to factual information and they were asking, aren't you curious about my suffering? And they didn't go into it. They were just pointing out that Dr. Ibsen doesn't step over any of it. And everyone that's posting now in some way or another is saying, look what we did. They're taking ownership of it.
Yeah, it was a large group of participants. And those are relationships that have been built over the last couple of years of me treating other pain refugees. And I can tell you what's really rewarding about treating pain refugees. You know, I used to be an ER doctor, and I attempted resuscitation on thousands of patients, and maybe 0.01% survived. You know, when you're getting resuscitated, you know you're already circling the drain.
Yeah.
The thrill of treating pain refugees is they know they're circling the drain, and that they're getting their life back with the medication that they cannot live without. And it's like providing oxygen to someone who can't breathe. It's the most rewarding thing I've ever done. It's the most demanding thing I've ever done. But, you know, knowing that these people who were all anticipating me losing my license and we were going to scramble about how to take care of them then, that all of the patients that are, they were on the edge of their seats wondering if it's going to work out for them. This time it did. And they are overjoyed that they have another day to live, another month to live, and another month to battle with the pharmaceutical companies or the pharmacies that won't fill their prescriptions and all that stuff. But it's like every patient had their life on the line on Friday. And on Friday evening, they could breathe again.
Yeah. And I think it's a testament to just what you represent in the pain community, to be honest with you. It's you have uniquely captured that symbolism of hope among many in the pain community. So congratulations for that.
Thank you.
So I wouldn't say it if it wasn't true. Now, in the remaining minutes that we have, can you two talk a little bit about the what's next? So we had a victory today. What comes next? What sort of advocacy comes next? What comes next in terms of your specific case? Give us a outline of the next few steps.
Well, grieving actually is coming next for me. I'm surprised. Somebody told me to party like it's 1999, and I did. And then I went skiing like I was 45, it was fun. I was energetic. I was filled with joy and swept up in that emotion. And the next day I was really sore. So I partied like it was 1999, but the next day I woke up like it was 2045. So for me, you know, consolidation, I think, is key. I think that's next. I think there's an opportunity to create a relationship with this medical board. They were signaling something. I don't know what. I don't know what happened in that closed session, but I do know that there might be an opportunity to create relationships with our boards where we're not quite so confrontational. And of course, I'd like to revolutionize how they do it and make it and put it in the medical model back instead of the legal model. So I think that's next. I think I still have patients. I spent 5 hours today with a patient who could not get their prescription filled no matter what, and that's extremely frustrating. So I think my self-care requires me to never put myself through this again.
Yeah.
And that involves using techniques that patients can get their relief from, and again, you know, minimizing the amount of opiates that are prescribed to patients, but also to look at the regulations and see where things are shifting. The California Medical Board has shifted, and MMEs are out. I just found out today that the Oregon Medical Board has eliminated MMEs or limits to opioid prescriptions. The Colorado law, which basically supports doctors in doing palliative care at no limits of doses, and some legal cases. I know of a legal case that's worth presenting of a patient who was force tapered by a famous HMO in California, and has been 2 years without medication, just suffering in agony, and that case was settled in the patient's favor. So I think we're seeing little, it might not be spring, but maybe there's a chance that the ice might break up and the rivers might.
It is dying for sure. It is dying for sure, and I think. I really like your approach of taking the board and forming a reconciliatory relationship. I think that's the best way to go. We have to essentially allow the ignorance to melt away. Allow those who have been perpetuating so strongly with this false narrative to have an out to say, hey, this is the bridge that we're building through. And I think you and I are similar in that capacity, where we see the best way to advocate and enact change is by holding hands, bridging, building bridges, and not just fighting in a very antagonistic manner.
Yeah. Now, it would help for them to pay me $5 or $6 or $10 million. But I think that would help. And given that the money's not flowing, or I don't anticipate it coming, I think that it might take me a few months to get to the spot where you are, which is let's have reconciliation, not conciliation, but reconciliation. And that I think it's possible. And I think hanging around Susan really helps me with that, because she really puts it into perspective.
Yeah.
Where, you know, I've been this victim for so long. Who am I going to be now? And so it's up to me to now to decide, well, am I going to stay in this business, or am I just going to run because it hurts so bad? And I'm staying in. I was just a little part of me was hoping they'd steal my license and I could just go work at Costco. But they didn't do that. So I won't voluntarily abandon them. I won't voluntarily abandon my patients. I did not get the opportunity to leave this behind. So obviously there's more to do.
Nice. Well said. And on that note, Dr. Ibsen, thank you so much for your time. As always, I will publish this widely and make sure that the pain community hears you loud and clear, as they always do.
Thank you. Thank you, Jay. I love you. Take like care. A brother.
Likewise.
Yeah, thank you.